when the Sox and Celtics and Patriots or Bruins are champions again, to the chagrin of New York and Chicago fans, the crowds will gather and watch a parade go down Boylston Street. And this time next year, on the third Monday in April, the world will return to this great American city to run harder than ever and to cheer even louder for the 118th Boston Marathon. Bet on it.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
This is our fucking city. And nobody gonna dictate our freedom. Stay strong. Thank you.
Well, it's interesting. It's a really, like I said, you don't really hear, there's plenty of people, I guess you could say, well, not plenty, but there's a handful of people who do talk about the possibility of this idea of sort of an internal civilization.
Yeah. And, you know, this is not a hollow earth theory. I'm not a hollow earther.
That's what I was going to ask you next. Now, you're more in favor of sort of this honeycomb idea, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's obvious that the earth itself is full of fissures and cracks and gaps. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the data, you'll see there's a layer between the crust mantle boundary. It's called the MOHO for short, or Rovesic or something like this. I believe it's a Serbian or Bosnian term. A name for the guy who discovered it. But the MOHO layer is worldwide. It's everywhere. And it's an anomalous region that can be found by, seismic readings. And it appears to be a cavern world that exists between the crust and the mantle. It's highly pressurized, but when they look at it, they can map, hills and valleys and mountains and everything. And we don't know what's there. But if you go around the world, for instance, if you go to Lechuguilla, in New Mexico, which is a big cave system, or Carlsbad, or a Blowing Cave, as it's called, you know, in Arkansas, other big cave systems all over the world, there's a steady, strong air current that blows out of these caves. Where's the air coming from? What region is generating a powerful air current that's so strong it can blow out from the interior of the earth? Obviously, there's something huge there that does this.
What do you think it is? I found myself puzzled by it because I obviously had read that part of the book where, you know,
if you look at ancient accounts, you'll find it. It's mentioned, you know, all over the world about this subterranean realm that exists, that is an ecosystem in and of itself. But periodically, you know, those who live there have to come out and take what they need because it's not completely self-sufficient. Obviously, it's away from the main source of the food chain, which is the sun, you know, and so it's going to have to come out and obtain resources and then, you know, take them back. But even take it even further, you'll find, for instance, in the ancient account, for instance, ancient Hebrew account of the cataclysm or the so-called flood, it's talking about an event where it sounds like something passed close to the planet that was large and it had a huge gravitational effect on the planet. Because it talks about something called the firmament, which was above the planet. It was like a shell of water. So there was land, and then there was the sky, and above the sky was the firmament. Well, people now think that means where the stars are, but that's not what it meant. It said there were waters in the firmament, waters above the earth. Well, that's talking about a shell of water that used to be suspended above the earth, kind of like the liqueous atmosphere that's above some of the larger, you know, gas planets.
Okay, yeah.
And it says that what happened when this event occurred, it says the windows of heaven were opened and this water started to fall. Simultaneously to this, there was some sort of huge gravitational pull, the same thing that disturbed, upset the balance of that layer of the atmosphere. Something else happened which disrupted the crust of the earth. It says, for the windows of heaven were opened and the fountains of the deep burst forth. And basically water burst from inside the earth due to gravitational and tidal forces. So my theory is that the MOHO may be what's left of what was once an internal region of water. And you look at the water in our oceans now, which are covering where they used to not cover. I mean, there's way too much water there. It was not there previously. Even during, you know, like the dinosaur age, the oceans were not that large.
Right.
Yeah, and you look now, you'll find, like I said, ruins, whether you're talking about the Yonaguni ruins off Japan or these new pyramids that have been mapped off the coast of Cuba, which are really deep, okay, in the Gulf of Mexico. But all over the place, you're finding these anomalies now that we can finally have the technology where we're starting to find these things. So water came from somewhere. So if it came from an outer shell above the Earth and from waters inside the Earth, that would explain where it came from. That would greatly explain the salinity of the oceans. And it would also explain this whole idea of this region at the crust mantle boundary that now reads as hollow, whereas before it may not have been that hollow.
Yeah.
And you know, like I said, ancient people were not stupid. They had their own way of explaining things. We just had to figure out what they were trying to tell us.
Hmm.
The thing about this is that when you look at all these ancient accounts from all over the world, you'll find the same story over and over again.
Right. You know, it's like 12 points that seem to trend, yeah, that connect all these stories.
Yeah. And so, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And Occam's razor would indicate that, you know, no matter how weird and absurd it might seem to our modern way of thinking, many times whatever is the most logical, simplest answer is going to be the true answer to the problem.
Right. And one would ask, in light of all this, people must have discovered some of these underground, you know, locations where there's entities or whatnot. And you do list a number of type instances in the book, right?
Right, exactly. And, you know, and even after the third edition, I've learned of new, you know, things that supposedly happened. I have a friend named Walter Bosley. Have you had Walter on the program?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Walter's a good friend.
Yeah, he's a good friend of mine. And Walter will tell you about an encounter that either his grandfather or his grandfather, I believe it was his grandfather, but it may have been his father, had, when they were on something to do with, they had a firefight in the Southwest against humans, who lived underground, and they accidentally encountered these people, and they had a disagreement, and it resulted in a fight. And he basically told Walter that he was in on the whole Roswell thing, and they were not aliens, and they were not, you know, Japanese, and they were not this and that, but that they were people, but they were people who live on this planet with us that we never see.
Huh.
His dad was in intel of some sort, and he told, you know, and Walter is an ex-intel agent, and he told him, you know, that these beings share the planet with us, and they don't want us to know they're here. So, you know, there are accounts of official encounters with these beings. And I think what we have to do is we have to be very careful, because there's a lot of, and from any source, there's a lot of disinformation and misinformation involved with all this stuff, especially if it relates to UFOs. But whether you're talking about the beings themselves, they seem to do nothing but spew misinformation and misdirection. And then you go higher up to other levels, government and other outlets, and you'll find more misinformation, or at least it seems to be that the case.
Right, right.
Yeah. It's in somebody's interest for us to think they're from Alpha Centauri rather than from here.
And it seems like the government, you know, seals off a lot of these types of potential gateways into this thing. Because you would think that if the entities inside have to come out to get stuff, then it can't be that far down to find them. You know what I mean? Although, well, there may be people that go and look, and next thing you know, they never turn up again. So,
right. Well, you know, I look at Richard Shaver's stuff quite a bit in the book. And on top of that, you know, you think about, like, for instance, Whitley Strieber. Okay. Is it Strieber or Strieber? I can't remember.
Strieber, I believe, yeah.
Strieber, yeah. Whitley, you know, in one of his books, he talks about this encounter that someone had at a bookstore. One of his experiencers went into a bookstore and found these two really small, strange people. They were all bundled up, almost covered, but you couldn't see what they looked like, a man and a woman, or male and female garb. And they were like 4 feet tall, and they were looking at his book, Communion, and they were flipping through it, and one of them was saying to the other, oh, no, he's wrong about this. Look, he got this wrong. Oh, he, and they were talking like they were in the know, and he didn't know anything.
Yeah.
And how they'd been fooled, basically. And the person looked at them and got a good look at them and said they were not human, as we would call human. They were like little people with huge eyes. And, you know, and again, there you have the whole huge eye thing. Look, you know, if you dwell in darkness most of the time or in dim light, and you've adapted to live in that environment, you're going to have great big eyes. If you're not completely blind like a cavefish, if you're somebody that uses your eyes and occasionally you come out, say, at night, you're going to have big eyes. You're going to have the eyes of a nocturnal thing. If you're a spacefarer who spends decades, you know, crossing vast distances or even years, and you've got a civilization that's intergalactic, you're not going to have huge eyes, because that would be a detriment, because that would allow more cosmic radiation and other forms of radiation to reach your optic center and damage you. Okay?
Yeah, I never thought of that.
So logically, if you have huge eyes, you're a nocturnal and or subterranean being. And when you start looking at the accounts of these beings, supposedly wearing the so-called black eyes are actually lenses, like giant contact lenses.
Yeah.
Well, then it makes sense, because these are beings that dwell in darkness. When they come out here, they put these lens covers on to protect their sensitive eyesight.
Well, like, thinking about all this, Mike, leaves me, you know, when I hang up the phone today, I'm wondering if I'm just going to be like, well, we're shit out of luck. I hate to get into the end game here, but is there anything we can possibly do about the fact that we're cattle to this race of people that live inside the earth?
I think it's like this. I think that most of the time they leave us alone. Most of the time. I think that we leave them alone almost all the time, because we don't have any other choice.
Yeah.
But you know, there's this thing going on where it's one-sided, and it shouldn't be. I also think that we shouldn't sweat it, because once you're aware that these things may be real, then you can take steps to kind of to make sure that you'll be able to take care of yourself. Put it that way.
Mm.
And if you read, you know, the new treatise, The Problem of Density in Regard to Non-Human Encounters.
Yes.
I touch on some of that a little bit, but in CCCC, there's even more information about that, more ideas, more indications. And as you go forward, you're going to see where it kind of goes. And it does deal with religious topics, because, you know, I think the ancients were telling us things that not because they wanted to control us with religion, and not because they wanted to manipulate future generations, but because they had figured some things out, and they wanted us to know that there were things we could do to protect ourselves, and there were things we could do to make sure that we remained the dominant species.
Right, right. Well, you introduced some of that stuff in the parts of the book that I've read so far, with the use of iron and invocation of religion. And one quote that you have here in the book was that you say, the more one learns about the ancient knowledge and traditions, the more it is seen that a spiritual yet physical and galactic war is behind all the myths, legends, religions, and traditions of our world. That's a pretty...
Right.
That's a pretty bold statement. I mean, what is this war between good and evil,
well,
on a greater sense, I guess?
Well, sure, because, you know, you have, whether you're talking about the Hindu Puranas and so forth, or if you're talking about Hebrew, Judeo-Christian viewpoint, Muslim viewpoint, even to some extent the Buddhist viewpoint, there's an indication that there's a war between good and evil that originates in high places. And well, you think of high places as being, you know, outer space, or do you think of it as being another dimension, a spiritual dimension? There's something that happened a long time ago, and it's not over yet. And the conflict is still going on, and we see it reflected around us all the time. In everything that we do, you know, in our lives, there are indications that there's more going on than meets the eye. And I think that, you know, when you go out and you look at things, for instance, like, you know, you have this whole idea where there was war in heaven, you know, and... But then if you look further into the Judeo-Christian point of view, you see that, well, that's not over. It's still going on. It's going on, supposedly, until the end of things when Christ returns. If you look at, for instance, the belief system of the Hindus, you'll see that there's war among the planets, but that they all have a vested interest in the earth, and many of them originated here before they went to the moon and the planets and stuff. So you find this theme everywhere, but you also find things like, you find the moon of Saturn called Iapetus. Have you heard of this?
I've heard of the moon. Yeah, I've heard of the moon of Saturn. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is, I believe it's Saturn. Maybe not, but it's Iapetus. And mm-hmm. Iapetus, if you find photos of Iapetus, it's made from what look like huge welded pieces of octagonal metal, almost like a geodesic dome.
Like the Death Star.
And right around the middle of and there's satellite photos. I mean, you can go look it up since we get off the phone. We probes out there that have looked at this thing. There's a ridge that runs around the center, what would be the equator of this object.
Right, I'm looking at it right now. Object. Yeah.
Yeah. And this thing that runs around the center looks like two lips at the top of two bowls that have been put together.
Right, like a seam.
Yeah, like a seam. And it's like a mile high, and it runs the entire circumference of this so-called moon. And you look at this thing, and it's rusted. It looks like it's oxidized. You're looking at a Death Star here. It's ancient, it's old, it's dead, but whatever it is, it was artificially created. There's no way in hell, okay, that thing evolved or came about from spinning matter or whatever. You're looking at two geodesic domes that have been fitted together to make an artificial moon.
For what purpose?
Well, there was war in heaven.
So you're saying heaven being space.
It could be space. It could also be on various levels. It could be on the quantum level. And, you know, we're talking about something that, you know, we think of ourselves as being so advanced. But our understanding can be so limited that we really are just barely getting the big picture.
Right. We don't even have the words to use almost.
Right.
Yeah. We're deep down the rabbit hole here in this case.
Right.
But
exactly.
I'm liking it.
Of what this actually means, you know, this idea of war in heaven came from, whether it's the, you know, from whatever tradition you're talking about, it's a spiritual war, okay? Spiritual could mean simply quantum war, you know? It could be, the quantum realm could be the source of all, of what we call spirit. You know, we don't know. But, you know, it's time for us to start trying to figure this out logically. And it's also time, I think, for us not to be scared to look at things and think out loud. Because, you know, you can't go around worrying all the time about what people are going to think and say and so forth. Because if you do, you're going to limit your ability to figure things out.
Absolutely, yeah. Like I said, we're deep down the rabbit hole here. And, well, hopefully we don't run into anything strange down there. Now, how do you also mentioned the elemental type beings in the in the book. So I guess, like, how do the elementals fit into this hierarchy of creatures, if you will?
Well, you know, I mean, what is an elemental? I mean, what we call an elemental, we're talking about a spirit, we're talking about a physical being, we're talking about one of these quantum beings that can move back and forth. I mean, who knows? It could be all of the above. People say, well, you know, that's not in the Bible. But actually, you know, people have said it to me, it is in the Bible. You know, you're told in the Bible to not have dealings with elemental beings. Well, if you're told not to have dealings with them, then that basically is saying that they exist. I think the whole idea there is that whatever those things are, they're kind of sort of the natural world in that they may be part of this quantum equation, but that we don't really interact with them. They have something that they do, and they're supposed to do it, and we leave them to do their thing, and they leave us to do our thing. Or that's the way it's supposed to work.
Right, but they're not leaving us alone.
It depends on what they really are. You know, calling jinn elementals is not accurate, okay? You know, to me, you know, the jinn would be the same thing as the so-called aliens, as the so-called quantum beings that can manipulate the quantum and physical realm for their own purposes.
But live within the earth.
So, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I guess let me hit on some stories that are in the book, because a couple times I earmarked virtually, because I read it on the Kindle, earmarked a couple of strange stories that I had never heard before. One of them was this, the story came from Betty Hill about this island that was populated by, for lack of a better term, Bigfoot, you know, a group of Bigfoot in Connecticut, which I thought was really crazy, and it went on for like 3 years. I guess extrapolate on that and tell me what you know about that, because I never heard that story before.
I'd have to, was that in caverns?
Yeah.
You know, here's the thing about it. Does this have to do with the fact that they would try to catch them and they would disappear?
I just mean in general how weird that is. I mean, it just doesn't seem to add up.
It's just the same thing you hear over and over again. I mean, you know, physical beings, you know, you should be able to run them down. You should be able to track them somehow, you know, watch them from an airplane or something. But no, they see them, they chase them, they run to a dead end and they're gone, you know. Again and again this happens. It happens not just with Bigfoot. It happens with, you know, the little people or you know, any anomalous being, you know, it seems to happen again and again. there's evidence that there was something physically there, but when you try to chase it down to its source, it eludes you always, always. And so,
and you think this has more to do with the manipulation of density rather than they can escape into a little hole all of a sudden, or maybe they can reduce their density to escape into a little hole.
Well, I think it could be both. I think it could be both. You know, if you read further in the book, you'll see an account by Spanish explorer who was in North America, and he was hanging out with some Indians, he and his men, and some Native Americans, and they found that these Native Americans were greatly in fear of a being that they called, in their language, Mr. Bad Thing.
Oh, yeah, I remember the story.
They called it Señor Malacosa, and this being supposedly came out of the earth, he could alter his density, and then he would come out through the cracks in the ground, and he would become physical, and he would do bad things to people, and cut people apart and put them back together, which, of course, sounds a lot like an alien abduction type scenario. And this Spanish explorer basically told them that, you know, they were familiar with things like this, and that where they came from, they had put an end to it by using religion to put an end to it, you know, their religious faith. And that's what they told these Indians to do. So, you know, you have these sorts of stories about these beings that have this malleable or this density that they can alter at will. And so you have to start wondering, you know, how would this fit into the scientific point of view? We can't just assume that all these stories are just, you know, the imaginings of madmen, because there are too many of them.
Right.
Okay? So, you know, you have to start saying, you know, let's look at this from a logical point of view, and let's look at the what we're learning more and more in the scientific realm, and see how it ties into this. And I think the more we do that, the more we see that there are connections, for instance, with quantum physics and quantum mechanics and things like this. And if we just extrapolate from the micro to the macro realm, that these things start to make more sense.
Well, it's you know, like I said, it's troubling because we're really left at the mercy of our own abilities, in a sense, and our abilities to perceive as well as defend against this thing, you know, whatever their agenda is.
Well, you know, you have legends all around the world. Again, every nation, every country, every people of beings that have come into conflict with the people of that land, and there's always some hero, this or that hero, who does prevail over them. I mean, you know, it may be a major undertaking, but it can be done. So, you know, I think it can be done.
Well, let's hope so. Well, I think you made a really good point here, and this kind of goes back to stuff we've been talking about earlier, but I think it bears mentioning, and I'm sure you'll have more to say about it, but that is that it stands to reason, you argue, that the diversity of the underground entities suggests that they must come from Earth, and additionally because they're mammalian or reptilian, which are earthly creatures.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, they have, okay, look, if you look at encounters with all these anomalous beings, or say 98% of them, including so-called, you know, aliens, you'll find that they follow an earthly vertebrate template. Just as do, for instance, you know, the demons and devils of medieval folklore, you know, an earthly vertebrate template. And that means they have one head, two eyes, a mouth, a nose, or nostrils or something.
Mm-hmm.
They have a neck. They have a central spine. They're bifurcated in that they have, you know, two arms, two legs. You know, there's basically a basic template, and then you take it even further, and they'll have mammalian, reptilian, amphibian characteristics, or any mix thereof. You know, they have all the characteristics of earthly life. You know, if you look at our biosphere, and I talk about this in the book, you know, if you were to come here from another planet and you've never seen any earth beings before, and you come here and you see a hermit crab, a Maasai warrior, an Eskimo, an elephant, a spider, and a blue whale, you would think, oh my God, you know, these must all come from different worlds, so it's too different. But genetically, they're all very closely related. They really are.
Yeah.
They all have a common genetic heritage and, you know, origin. So, that when you start looking at it like that, these beings that appear so outrageous when people first see them because they're strange, they seem so, you know, otherworldly, but really they're not otherworldly at all because they fit quite well into the biodiversity of the Earth. In fact, they fit even closer to us than, say, a blue whale does, or a dolphin, or a hermit crab.
Right, right, because they're, you know, sentient. They have...
They're humanoids.
They're more human. Yeah, exactly. That was the word I was looking for. They're humanoids.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, obviously, it's more in their interest to for us to believe that they're gods, that they're so superior to us that we have no choice, that they're doing us a favor when they do the things they do, that they come from another planet, that they come from far, far away. All these things, to me, are no different than the guy who wants to sell you the Brooklyn Bridge.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't trust anything that came out of the inside of the Earth if it was talking to me. You know,
how do you know what it is or where it comes from? You don't know, you know.
Right.
So here's the thing. You know, my advice to people that are into this kind of stuff, don't believe everything you hear, whether it's from people like me and you and anybody else. Think for yourself, figure it out, and weigh the evidence for yourself, and then certainly do not believe anybody that says they've got, that seems to have an agenda where they want to be a big shot and they want to be the expert on something, because a lot of times they're going to try to keep you from finding out other information.
Right.
And the third thing is, don't believe the anomalous phenomena itself.
That's absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the mistake most people make, you know.
Yes, it is.
They take the Ouija board's word for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, one thing that you said in the book completely blew me away was that only human beings have over 4,000 known genetic defects.
Right.
I mean, and that goes into the whole genetic tinkering idea, but I mean, that's a lot. We're not talking about, you know, a handful here. So, I mean, what do you make of that? I won't even begin to suppose. I'll just ask, what do you make of that?
You know, I think there's a lot going on there. I think that it could be that there are, you know, crossbreeding things. And honestly, since I wrote that, more information has come out. That was written several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we know through the Human Genome Project, for instance, now here we go, I'm going to be very politically incorrect, and I guess your listeners will just have to deal with it because that's tough. But this is not me, this is science, okay? The Human Genome Project has now basically discovered that Northern Europeans and Europeans in general have about 4% Neanderthal DNA. 4% of our DNA is Neanderthal.
Mm-hmm.
Asians have about 2% Neanderthal DNA, I believe it was about 2%, and about 2% of something called Denisovian DNA. Okay, Neanderthals and Denisovians are not modern humans. Okay?
Right.
So we are hybrids. We are a hybrid species. Then they find that sub-Saharan Africans have zero Neanderthal DNA and zero Denisovian DNA. They are whatever they originally have been. But now, last week, a story came out where an African-American man, his family gave his DNA to the Human Genome Project after he passed away, and you can find this online, and his DNA indicated that unlike every other human sample of DNA that has been looked at by the Human Genome Project, that his DNA, his male paternal DNA going all the way back, is 340,000 years old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Whereas before, they had figured out that all human beings have a common male ancestor about 240,000 years ago or 220,000 or something. So, you know, some number like that. This guy has a paternal ancestor that is so old that the geneticist said it predates humans. Now, that's a big statement because that's saying that it predates Homo erectus, who was a type of human. It predates Homo ergaster, who was a type of human. Homo means human.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're talking about basically what they're finding is that the races of the Earth, so-called races, our differences may be due not just to what we have in common, because we do, we have a lot in common, but also to what we don't have in common.
Which is these ancestry.
So, yeah, which is ancestry. So if you start looking at it like that, and then you take it one step further and you say, okay, now if that's going on, what if some of these ancient groups of people went underground? What if some of these ancient groups of people developed civilizations and left the planet, and now they're coming back from nearby planets? What if some of these ancient groups of people have been here all along and have been manipulating things and taking advantage of the other groups of people. And what if some of these have diverged so far from the common tree that when they do interact with us and crossbreeding does occur, that there are genetic problems?
That would explain all these genetic differences.
Yes.
Yes,
it would.
You know, we certainly don't hold science to up as a god here on this program either, but what does mainstream science have to say about all these genetic abnormalities?
Well, nothing really. I mean, but this human genome thing seems to me to indicate that, you know, finally we can talk about these things without somebody saying, well, if you say that, you know, that I'm part Neanderthal, that you're racist, or if you say that this African guy is part pre-Homo erectus, that you're a racist. You know, it's a bunch of crap because it's a way to shut people up.
Right.
You know, now when you finally put science in it, you know, you'll notice when you read these articles that they really try to dance around these things, but they do come out and tell you that this is what they're finding. So to me, that makes it more fascinating because that means that, you know, all these beings in the fossil record, or not all of them maybe, but a lot of them, they didn't just disappear, you know, go extinct. But they bred with people who became modern humans, and that's where we all came from.
Yeah.
And to me, that's fascinating.
That just is, that goes back to the whole kind of like ancient aliens idea, but it's been corrupted by the outside alien concept, if you will.
Yeah.
We're talking about, you know, just a change in the human race, and then maybe the changers just went underground, possibly.
Yeah, maybe more times than once. I mean,
right.
I'll give you a good example, man. You know,
it could be all over the planet, too. You know what I mean? Where one place, they might have done something here, and they might have done something at another place.
Sure. And, you know, I talked about this in CCCC, you know, the whole Flores Hobbit, as they call it, situation. I mean, what basically happened there was they discover this cave, and in it they find indications of multiple generations of habitation by a non-human, not modern human, but still somewhat some kind of human. They call it Homo floresiensis or Flores human.
Yeah, the hobbits.
Yeah, but they find that these things lived there for 80,000 years. 80,000 years. Modern humans, in whatever forms we've had, we've supposedly been around for about 100,000 years, or maybe not even that long. People say 50,000 if you just talk about, you know, Cro-Magnon and Homo sapiens. So, you know, or 60,000. But these things were living on that island in that cave for 80,000 years. That means that when the sea levels were lower, they might have been able to walk to the mainland. Okay? Because they're an island chain that runs up to Asia.
Right.
Or in 80,000 years, at some point, some of them would have gotten to the mainland. I'm sorry, it would have happened. They might have floated on a log by accident, but somebody would have got there. Okay? That's just the way things work. So then you have legends all over the world of little people. Well, we modern humans, in our various forms, because that's what we're talking about, kind of like subspecies of, or subbreeds of dogs, that's what humans are, you know, our various forms. We colonized the planet. Why couldn't these little people have colonized the planet? They learned to stay away from us, mostly, except when they want something. So you have legends all over the world about little people who live in caves, who live underground, and then you have this find in Flores. Then you take it a little bit further and you start looking at the folklore of the Flores Islanders. The Flores Islanders say, oh yeah, we know all about those little people. We killed them all about 400 years ago. Oh, then the scientists say, that can't be true because the most recent find we found, most recent bones we found were only 8,000 years old. They said, oh no. So, you know, we call them Ibu Gogo, which means little grandmother who eats everything. And they said, you know, they came into the village, they would come down to the villages at night, they would steal livestock, crops, and babies.
Hmm.
Okay? And so we got tired of it, we went back to their caves, and we built huge fires in the mouth of the cave, and we burned it for days and days, and it sucked all the air out of the cave, and they all died. They told how they killed them and everything. Okay? Hmm. Okay, so now you look in Northern Europe. For instance, for the British Isles, you have legends of little people who come out at night, they steal livestock, they steal crops, and they kidnap human infants. You go to Northern Europe, you find the same thing. You go to Japan, you find the same thing.
Right.
You go to just about anywhere, you find the same legends. And here we have this physical proof from Flores Island that there were beings like that that actually lived, and that according to the local people, their habits were the same as all these other folkloric forms. So again, Occam's razor tells us that no matter how absurd it may seem at first, that the most logical explanation is going to be the simplest explanation, and that is that these beings did exist and they very well have spread around the world just like we did. And as they went, they evolved, they changed, they developed, and they became characteristic of whatever region they lived in, just like we did.
Exactly. But do you think, see, but these, they sound more feral, if you will, unless the intelligent sort of depictions that we see of the ETs. So, but we've talked here at length about an ecosystem. So there could be multiple different, multiple different sort of entities and beings. Some may be evil, some may be indifferent.
Well, you know, you think about it like this. If you were 3 feet tall, 2 to 3 feet tall, and everybody else around you was a giant, and you're competing for resources, your best bet is going to be to come out at night and take what you want.
Right.
And over time, you're going to develop strategies and other things that make that much easier for you to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where your chances of success are going to be greatly enhanced. So, to us it's evil, and I'd say somebody kidnapping babies for any purposes is evil, but, you know, we're talking about something here that is alien to us in that it's not human like we are, but it's still, part of this world's ecosystem and planet. It's not, you know, you said feral. Yeah, I guess they're feral, but we're feral too. I mean, we go out, if you want to use that terminology, we go out and we kill food and we take other animals back and raise them in captivity so we can kill them and eat them. That's kind of feral.
Right, I suppose, yeah. I meant wild.
But the thing is, supposedly some of these underground diminutives, they develop their own civilizations. Over time, they would, obviously, you know. They're going to develop their own civilizations. Maybe these are the source of some of the diminutive so-called aliens that people see.
Mm.
You know, who knows? We're just now starting to figure these things out. And it's interesting to me how more scientific discoveries seem to point to there being evidence for these various folklore accounts from all around the world.
Well, I thought it was interesting, too, to go back to the folkloric part, that, you know, in the 12... trends, I guess you could say, or overarching themes. One of them was that that there's this sort of aspect where part of it is that these people or these entities or this ecosystem is in on purpose or by choice underground. But there's also this whole aspect of that there's some kind of race that's like locked underground that's being held captive inside the earth, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, and that's the same thing I talked about earlier with the fathers of the Nephilim, you know, who would have been involved in the so-called war in heaven at some point, probably. But, you know, they're locked underground because they were given this great edict, which is kind of like the Star Trek thing, you know, don't get involved with what's going on the planet, you know, what these people are doing, you know, the Prime Directive, you know.
Yeah.
And they violated the Prime Directive by basically interbreeding with human beings and then taking their sons who were hybrids, who had a certain form of hybrid vigor, both physically and intellectually, and they set their sons up as demigods to be worshipped and to rule everybody else. And so, you know, their punishment is not only are we going to destroy your sons, your offspring, and their offspring, but at the same time, you're going to be put somewhere where you can't do this again.
Mm. Right.
And, you know, the Book of Enoch, Book of Jasher, the Book of Jubilees, they all talk about this. The Book of Jude in the New Testament has a direct quote from the Book of Enoch. About half the Book of Jude comes directly from the Book of Enoch. Most Christians don't know that, but it does. So obviously it was considered inspired enough to put in the Bible, where it talks about, it says, for the angels who kept not their first estate, but lusted after strange flesh, are bound in chains of eternal darkness until the judgment of the great day. So, you know, this is a theme, though, that's not just in Christianity. It's in various other ancient traditions. It's a very old theme, you know, that there was this group of beings who decided they were going to break all the rules and that their descendants may still be around.
Yeah. It makes you wonder, when the end times come, is it because they figured a way out?
Well, you know, if you read the literature like the Apocalypse or Revelation, it talks about Abaddon, who is in the Greek Apollyon, the destroyer. He's called the angel of the bottomless pit, and he opens up the bottomless pit and he releases all these terrors. So
that, yeah, that's what we might have to look forward to.
Hey, man, lock and load.
Exactly, yeah. It's just overall, this whole thing is fascinating, and I can't put over caverns, cauldrons, and concealed creatures enough. And, you know, it's a testament to you that, and you know, a detriment to my own abilities as a reader, that it's so deeply well-researched that after a while, I just found myself getting lost in all these stories. Because it is such an amazing collective history of something going on underground that it surprises me that, I guess, that, I don't know, that this isn't even something that's, I mean, you talk about ETs and UFOs and stuff like that being ridiculed and marginalized by the mainstream, but the whole idea that there's even a possibility of some kind of underground ecosystem is not even remotely discussed by the mainstream.
Well, why do you think that is?
They don't want us to look, man. They don't want us to even think about it.
They don't want you to look, yeah. They don't want you to look. Why should you figure out what that used to be called the secret of the ages.
Yeah.
Why do they want you to figure out the secret of the ages? They, you know, it's one of those things where if they can have you watching vapid reality programs about the paranormal and the strange, and, you know, they can keep you believing whatever this or that person says and the so-called experts and everything's ancient aliens, and they can keep you, you know, completely bound up in not thinking and just being force-fed this stuff, and they don't have to worry about whatever benefits they may or may not derive from that information themselves.
Right.
You know.
Now, you know this is like the secret of the ages. Has anyone ever been like, listen, Mike, just don't go there. Just get off the underground thing. This is too...
I have had a lot of weird stuff happen.
Like what?
What you feel comfortable talking about. I'll just give you one example,
sure.
But I mean a lot of weird stuff. I was going to do a show with Kevin Smith. You know who Kevin Smith is?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
This show?
Yep.
Yeah. So I was going to do this thing. It was called the Alternate Universe Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of his first speakers. And I had this elaborate slideshow set up on actually what ended up becoming eventually The Problem of Density in Regard to Non-Human Encounters as a book. At first it was a much smaller slideshow and talk. And I was going to do this show for over Skype with him. And so he gets me on the line, and then, just as I'm about to start talking, he puts me on hold. And on my screen, it says, on hold. Kevin Smith, you know how Skype has a little icon to the side.
Yeah.
Call on hold. Meanwhile, on his end, I just disappeared.
Huh.
There was nothing. And he kept trying to recontact me, and there was no contact. Finally, he called my cell phone, but see, he had to keep on going because the thing was an ongoing event, a paid event where people paid to participate.
Yeah.
It was a live stream.
Yeah, it's like the iConference thing, probably before
the iConference.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I knew something weird was going on, so I took screenshots of everything. And so we got together, and I seen the screenshots, and he said, no, man, he said, I never put you on hold, you know.
Weird.
And yeah. And so I got back on the next time he had one, and I did my thing. But that's just one example. Things like that happen. You know, and you have to start, when something like that happens, you know, you have weird stuff happen like 15 or 20 times, you have to start wondering.
Right. Now that's kind of a weird technical thing, but have you ever been like, you know, warned off or threatened or anything like that? Or is it kind of, you know, you kind of left to do your own thing?
I kind of left to do my own thing for the most part. I mean, you get weird things that happen, but you know, I think that your attitude is going to, whatever your personal attitude is going to influence how people attempt to shut you up, probably.
Right. So, if you're open to being shaken up, then you're going to get shaken up.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I've had a lot of weird stuff happen, but I've never had anybody actually come out and say, you better shut up, you better not do this or that.
That's good. Yeah, no one wants that to happen.
Yeah, and if I did, if it happened, then I would just be more encouraged. I would actually find that very gratifying.
Yeah, because then you know you're really stepping on some toes there.
Yeah.
Now, I take it, have you ever gone – see, because I'm kind of claustrophobic. I wouldn't even go into one of these caves or caverns and stuff. And you have stories in the book of people who have gone into these things. I mean, have you ever done that? Or I would not suggest people do that, but, you know.
Years ago, yes, I did. I have done that. It's, you know, no weird encounter or anything. Very strange, though. Very strange environment. Very hostile. Talking about like a, what's called a wild cave. You know, no evidence of civilizations in the ones that went in, but they were ones that cavers or spelunkers frequented quite often.
Yeah.
Very dirty. Lots of bat guano everywhere, you know, that kind of thing. But I'll tell you one thing. You have never experienced darkness until you go way down in the cave and turn all the lights off.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, I mean, that's
it's almost physical. It's so thick. I mean, it's indescribable. You think it's dark in your room when you close all the, you know, the blackout curtains and, or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nothing. It's indescribable unless you go down in there. But, you know, there are plenty of encounters that people have reported in caves, in mines, trap miners and trap cavers and stuff, of anomalous events. And I can't remember what it was, but recently, just very recently, there was an event where somebody was underground and they said something strange happened that indicated that they weren't down there by themselves. I can't remember exactly what it was, though.
See, that would be the scary part, too, because, like, you know, you can go down in there for, like, days and keep going deeper and deeper, right?
Yeah, you could.
Oh, God.
And sooner or later, you're going to, you'll die of thirst or hunger or something. Hypothermia. Hypothermia is a big one.
You mentioned one guy in the book who was, it was from the Shaver era, who went in and he, I think you said he died of like a yellow jacket attack or something crazy like that.
Yeah, that was a very strange thing. His name was Charles Marcoux.
Mm-hmm.
And he was big into the Shaver theory and stuff. And there's a cave in Arkansas called Blowing Cave. And there were some guys that found a hole in the floor in one of the caverns in that cave, one of the rooms, and they went down the hole and they had this story. They told of how they went through several caves and caverns, and then eventually they came to what was obviously a machine tunnel. And as they went along the machine tunnel, it became a phosphorescent, and they had all these, eventually they encountered some people who lived down there, who basically told them that they had fled underground during the cataclysm that we call the flood, and that they had been down there ever since. Which kind of ties in with everything else we've been talking about.
Yeah.
So it was a really big deal, and these people had a lot of credibility, so people believed that they were telling the truth. And Marcoux decided he was going to lead an expedition into Blowing Cave. So they went to lead the expedition, and when they got in there, this hole in the ground, a huge slab had fallen from the ceiling and covered the hole that they'd all seen there before. It was completely buried. And then they were attacked by yellow jackets, and they swarmed on Marcoux and stung him to death.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
That's horrifying.
Very strange.
What the hell's a yellow jacket doing in a cavern?
well, yellow jackets live underground.
Yeah.
And, like, they have their nests underground, but it's just, you know, it's a type of anomalous thing that seems to happen a lot when people get too close to some of these sites.
Right. And you mentioned, too, it seems like whenever somebody finds one of these things, they come back and it's all disrupted, covered up, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So.
It happens all the time.
So if you're under there, you know, and somebody comes in and finds you, of course you're going to, like, you know, destroy your doorway and find a new way out and stuff.
Right.
So makes sense from their point of view on the inside.
Hey, work for the Viet Cong.
Exactly. Now tell me a little bit about Unraveling the Secrets. This is your radio show with Tim Swartz and Rick Osmond. So what's that all about, and how that come about, and what do you guys got going on there?
Well, Rick has left the show finally. He came off and on for a while, and he finally decided to call it quits, so now it's just Tim and I. And as you know, if you know Tim Swartz, Tim's a really good guy. He's a major investigator of the paranormal and the Altre and the 4TN. He's a conspiracy guy. He runs a website called Conspiracy Journal, conspiracyjournal.com. And so Tim and I was brought onto the show as a favor to Rick and the original host, Rick and Dennis Crenshaw. And Dennis left, and he asked me to be on. And at that time, I came on with a guy who's now my publisher, Brian Kennard of Graves Distractions.
Mm-hmm.
So we were on there as the host, and then Rick came back. So there were three hosts, and it was a lot of fun. We kind of do a roundtable conversational thing on there. And then after a while, Brian left because the publishing company was taking up so much of his time. He's got so many books going now. And I brought Tim on to be host with me. And then Rick came back, and then Rick left again, so now it's just me and Tim. So it's been a kind of a roller coaster, but I've been there for about 2 years now, I think, or a year and a half.
Nice.
And it's a lot of fun. We have a lot of interesting guests, interesting topics, and we're not politically correct. We have a lot of fun on there. And we have the producer comes on some, and he's kind of a character, so we have a lot of fun with him. But it comes on Saturday night. if you go to unravelingthesecrets.com, you can listen live, and there's a call-in number and a chat room and all this kind of stuff, and it's from midnight Eastern till 2 a.m. on Saturdays.
Nice, nice. Yeah, I'm checking out the website right now. It looks pretty cool. Yeah. So.
Yeah, and also,
mm-hmm.
You know, we really look for people to call in and interact. But to us, when we can get that's big. So people like to call in and interact with hosts on these topics. That's a good show to do it on.
Nice, nice. Yeah, sounds good. Now, what's next for you? Of course, people can find out more at mottimorphic.com, and that's spelled MOTTIMorphic.com. Pretty simple
right.
to put all that together. There'll be links all over Banal of America for it. But
yeah.
What do you now? This is the third edition of CCCC. Do you expect a fourth edition down the line? Are you going to work? And obviously, you have the new piece out. I don't have it in front of me here. Let me get my notepad up here. Obviously, you have the problem of density in regard to non-human encounters. That's out right now, too. So what do you got cooking, I guess, is the best way to put it?
Well, you know, first, if people go to mottimorphic.com, mottimorphic.com, they can find links to all my books. I would prefer for them to go there to find the links because I want them to get the editions of my books that are authorized by me and are not being pirated. So that would be the place to do it. They will find it. Less expensive editions. You know, nothing kills me so much as seeing somebody selling an old edition that's being illegally produced for $150 on Amazon when they can go get one for $17.95 and it's a more recent edition with more stuff.
Yeah, that's pretty, pretty messed up that people are pirating that. That's,
exactly.
That's messed up.
So anyway, so if they go to monomorphic.com, they can get the latest books, not just the nonfiction stuff, but my fiction work, which is sort of satirical. Fantasy fiction, it's a lot of fun, it's funny stuff, and some pulp fiction, I write pulp fiction of various types, so they can go there and check that out, and see some art samples in my art galleries and stuff that are there, and I don't think I'm going to do another CCCC edition, I think I'm going to move on to new things in that area. Right now I'm doing a lot with the radio show, and also got some new ideas for some other books, but I'm not going to talk about them just yet until they coalesce. That's what I did with the last one, with the treatise on the density.
Yeah.
I kind of let people know I was working on something, but, I didn't want to come out and say it because I didn't want everybody jumping on it before I actually got it out there. So
exactly.
I've got some things going on, and, of course, I work as an artist, and a freelance artist and designer, too. So
nice.
So anyway, if people want to go to mottimorphic.com, they can find out whatever they need to know.
Awesome, awesome. Well, on that note, Mike, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. I just really enjoyed this conversation, and the 2 hours flew by. I'm stunned that it's already 4:15 here, and we started at about 2:10. So I just can't believe we've gone so long, and really just such an engrossing conversation. Really kind of threw the talking points out the window and just jammed with you, and really enjoyed it quite a bit. As we've said here over the course of the program, the new treatise is The Problem of Density in Regard to Non-Human Encounters. That'll give folks a lot of insight into what may be going on here with these, let's call them alternative entities for now. And I cannot put over Caverns, Cauldrons, and Concealed Creatures enough. This really is the definitive book on what may be going on right under our feet. And for people who haven't really considered the possibility, you would definitely want to go out and pick up this book because it is tremendous and just amazingly well-researched, completely thorough, looking at all of the traditions of these stories about things underground and then looking at what may be going on and what it might be all about. So, like I said, I cannot put it over enough. Thoroughly enjoyed the book and really enjoyed this conversation, Mike. So, again, thank you for coming on the show.
Well, Tim, thanks a lot for inviting me. I really appreciate it. We'll have to have you on Unraveling the Secret sometime.
I'd be happy to do it, buddy.
All right. Thank you, man.
That does it for this edition of BOA Audio Season 7. Big, big thanks to William Michael Mott for coming on the show and giving us so much time. Be sure to check out his websites, www.mottimorphic.com. You spell that MOTTIMORPHIC.com. And be sure to tune into his podcast, www.unravelingthesecrets, which can be heard at unravelingthesecrets.com. Check it out. Moving right along now, it's time for BOA Audio Listener Feedback.
However, as is the case when we have a long delay between episodes, we are going to eschew listener feedback here on this edition of the program because I want to get the show out to folks as fast as possible and because I want to take a moment here and reflect on the Boston Marathon bombings, which took place a couple of weeks ago and really just a few miles here from BOA HQ. And that's really the reason why it's taken so long for us to get this program out to folks. It's kind of strange in a lot of ways when reality butts up against the proverbial unreality of the paranormal. And for the last couple of weeks, I just haven't really felt as motivated as usual to get back on the esoteric horse, if you will, when the real world has this tremendous pull on you to get back into the speculative realm of the paranormal is sort of a difficult proposition. And before I even get into all that, I guess I'll throw out a little warning here for folks. Language may get a bit colorful, so if you're listening with some kids, wait to tune into this segment later on down the line, because I may get into some colorful language, and I want to give people a heads up here as we proceed. Thankfully and fortunately, I don't have any crazy story to share with people. I was well away from harm's way, although I want to thank all the folks who reached out to me in the aftermath of the bombing to make sure that I was doing okay. But I know plenty of people that knew people that were affected by it, and I know people that were perilously close to being affected by it. A very good friend of mine was eating at a restaurant maybe two blocks from the finish line and was going to be at the finish line if she had been allowed to cross the road. So this thing hit home in just such a deep way that it's difficult for me to even get it across, really, I think, to the listeners here. Just to give you some perspective on Patriots Day here in Massachusetts, it's kind of like our own personal 4th of July, and it's a celebration of, obviously, the first shots fired in the American Revolution, as well as sort of this athletic tradition that is Boston, with the Boston Marathon and the annual morning Red Sox game, which is the only baseball game they play in the morning. And it is just the best day of the year. Everybody loves Patriots Day. We call it Marathon Monday. And if you're not working, and a lot of people aren't because all the state and federal employees have the day off in Massachusetts, if you're not working, you're celebrating, you're at a barbecue somewhere, you're going into Boston to see the marathon, you're going to the Red Sox game. It's really a very unique celebration of Massachusetts and Boston. So that's what really profoundly affected so many people here. This is one of the very best days of the year, and for this to happen was shocking, horrifying, really, in a lot of ways. And of course, my heart goes out to all the people who were injured and the folks that died as a result of the bombing and the subsequent manhunt. The best way to really try and get this across to folks is between April 15th, when the bombing happened, and April 19th, when the manhunt concluded, we are talking about just a non-stop barrage of news coverage. You could not go anywhere without hearing about this. And even today, I see the faces and the names of the victims everywhere, all the time, and you just cannot escape it. So I take this very personally. Ultimately, that's really what kept me from jumping back on the horse here at Banal of America, because I was glued to the TV and the internet over that entire week, following this story, watching it all unfold, and last week in the sort of quiet aftermath of it all, really just needed sort of a week to decompress from all that, because it was absolutely exhausting, especially that final 24 hours where the entire city of Boston was locked down, the entire city of Watertown was locked down, a whole bunch of surrounding communities were locked down. Where I live, a very large percentage of the businesses were shut down because their employees live in areas where they could not leave their homes. So it completely paralyzed the entire Boston metro region. And even if we weren't locked down, nobody wanted to leave the house because everybody was just completely captivated by the manhunt situation. So that was kind of an interesting turn of events, I guess you could say. And I've seen some folks out there taking shots at the lockdown situation and the subsequent manhunt and saying how the people of Boston allowed this martial law situation to happen and they didn't stand up to the police and all this other horseshit is really what it is. Because what happened, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many, 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 I'd say probably the vast majority of people who live in the area, was that we wanted these guys brought to justice. And we were willing to do whatever it took. And if that meant staying at home on a Friday and not leaving the house and letting the police and all of the various law enforcement agencies take to the streets and find this guy, that's what we were willing to do. We were willing to shut down the entire region to capture this guy. It was a cooperative community effort. It wasn't some kind of nefarious government plot to keep everybody in their homes and exercise martial law to see if they could pull it off. It was, as I said, a cooperative community effort. And to read some of the conspiracy-minded folks criticizing the people of Boston for that is just absolutely foolish and just ridiculous. I can't stress that enough. We were willing to do whatever it took to catch this guy, and that was the perspective of, I'd say, just about everybody in the area. Because we were so hurt and angry. I cannot express that enough to you folks. Marathon Monday is a great source of civic pride. So for that event to be attacked, for that day to suffer such a tragedy, I don't have the words to express really what that meant for a lot of us. It brought up heartbreak. It brought up anger. It brought up bewilderment. How could somebody do this to us? And I'm getting choked up just thinking about it, because that was really the feeling of so many of us that day, that we just could not believe that someone could be so evil. It really was an emotional day. I'm still emotional when I think about it. It was just surreal is still the word I keep going back to. Just a very, very surreal turn of events. I know I'm probably going to disappoint some of my listeners here when I say this, but I just cannot get on board with this just mindless talk that this was some kind of false flag terror attack. I do not believe it. It just does not add up to me, but I'm also not some blind believer in everything I'm told by the government. I've been doing this far too long for that. So, sure, there may have been some nefarious cover-up in the sense of a cover-your-ass responsibility type thing. Maybe somebody dropped the ball along the way and this could have been prevented, and we're not going to get the full story there. I'm perfectly open to that kind of thing. But to think that the government orchestrated this entire thing and set off those bombs, and these two guys, that one of them's dead and the other one's been arrested, that they're patsies, it doesn't pass the banal smell test. It does not have the veracity that I expect from a credible theory. There's a possibility that there's some shenanigans involved from the government to tailor the story of what went down to make them look good. I'm perfectly willing to take a look at that kind of thing, but I just do not at all see any evidence that this was some kind of false flag terror attack. And I just am absolutely disgusted by the folks who jumped on this as soon as it happened and were declaring false flag terror attack and saying crazy shit, saying mindless stuff, that the victims of the bombing were actors hired by the government. Give me a fucking break. Are you kidding me? Some little kid, some 8-year-old fucking kid is dead. And what are you going to say? His sister who lost her legs, she's a fucking actor? Get the fuck out of here, you know? Those are the kind of people that get me so angry. They don't know what they're talking about. They're making shit up. And, you know, when you live in Texas, or you live in Pittsburgh, or you live in Minnesota, or you live in Seattle, you know, it's really easy to watch this stuff and say, oh, this looks like a movie. This is fake. But when you live in the area and you see the victims on your local news every day, and you see the updates from the people who lost their limbs and are just getting out of the hospital and face a tremendously difficult life for themselves ahead, and then you get on the computer and you see some idiot saying that they're actors, as I said, folks, give me a fucking break. You don't know what you're talking about. And a lot of these folks who are really driving this story are, quite frankly, just exploiting it to make money, to generate website hits, to sell DVDs, and to generate fear for their audience. So that's the way I feel. And, you know, if I've upset people because I don't get on board with the false flag conspiracy talk, you know, I'm not going to apologize because it's bullshit. It makes me very angry, and it makes me very, very disappointed in a lot of people out there who probably have the best intentions, but are really being led astray by people who I believe don't have the best intentions. There's this fear-mongering attitude, there's this rush to declare false flag as soon as something happens that is just absolutely fucking ridiculous. I can't say that more clearly. If you believe some of these conspiracy folks, everything is a conspiracy. So we're saying what? Aurora and the Newtown shootings and now the Boston bombing. This is all false flag. I'm sorry, but anybody that believes that, you need to get in line with reality. The human race is very good, but there are evil elements, and sometimes these evil elements strike out at us. And that's what happened in Boston, and that's what happened in Newtown, and that's what happened in Aurora. These aren't grand conspiracies, folks. They're just human nature, sadly. And I don't quite know what else to say. I kind of just wanted to give everybody my take on what went down. And in a way, I'm glad it took me a couple weeks here to get this out there, because I didn't want to really, you know, insert myself into all this. A lot of people kind of made this about themselves, and that's not my thing. I don't want to do that. I've never been that kind of person or broadcaster or journalist or entertainer or whatever the hell you want to call me. I'm not somebody that immediately needs to jump in and say, you know, let me weigh in, because my perspective is important. I don't feel that way. Now, here, a couple of weeks removed, there were things I wanted to say, and I feel like I have kind of said them here. And again, thank you to all the folks who reached out. Obviously, I was clearly fine from all of this, aside from being emotionally shook up and pretty perturbed by what went down. And let's hope we never have to go through this again, because it was really troubling on a deep and profound level. And I guess we have to move on. We have to continue onward. And that's what we do here on Banal of America. So on that note, let me give you the means to contact me if you'd like to be a part of future installments of BOA Audio Listener Feedback. You can write to boaaudio@hotmail.com. You can head on over to Banal of America and click the contact button. or you can join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. That is BOA's Paranormal Playground, where we discuss the world of pop culture as well as esoterica. And, of course, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. Just punch in Binall, B-I-N-N-A-L-L, and my profile should pop right up. Feel free to befriend me, follow me, or poke me. It's all good, and I'd be happy to have you as part of my online circle of friends. And, of course, let's take a moment here and plug Binall of America on Facebook. You can find that at B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America. Punch it into Facebook. We're up to 976 likes. So if you're listening to the program and you have not liked BOA yet on Facebook, punch in Binall of America and like us. The person who is our 1,000th like will get a shout-out here on the program, and I'll probably have to throw some shout-outs to people who are numbers 999 and 1,001 because they just narrowly missed the cutoff. But shout-outs in the future for those folks who hit us on the milestone like. Now let's give the requisite shout-out to the BOA staff, Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, Tony Morrill, our webmaster, Ray Weigel, and our graphics guru, Jeremy Boston. BOA 3.0 is very, very close to launching. Hopefully, in the next few weeks, we will roll out the new Binall of America for everybody to check out. So stay tuned to Binall of America, because we are about to take it to the next level, my friends. Considering that it has been way too long since the last edition of the program, we are going to skip out on asking for donations. I want to give a big thanks to the folks who did donate after my call for help there at the beginning of the month. Thanks to those folks who stepped up and contributed to the BOA franchise. You know who you are. It is greatly appreciated. I will hit you up once again for donations on the next edition of the program. On that note, let me plug the next edition of BOA Audio. You will not have to wait nearly as long for that installment of the show as you have had to wait for this one. Our guest will be Dr. Tyler Cokejohn, who is a very good friend of our friends at Paratopia and Project Archivist. He is a microbiologist. He is working on a cure for Alzheimer's, and he is someone with a deep interest in the world of the paranormal. He reached out to me following the Sharon Hill edition of the program with his kudos and thanks for that episode, and I reached out back to him and said, let's do a program, man, because I've heard some of your stuff on Paratopia and Project Archivist, and I think you'd be an awesome guest for BOA Audio. That suspicion was confirmed when we sat down and had a conversation that lasted well over 3 hours, talking about just a whole host of topics, including the world of the paranormal, the challenges of getting the paranormal research to be looked at and acknowledged by mainstream science, as well as a whole bunch of health-related stuff, such as the dangers of emerging diseases, and a whole slew of other stuff. I'm kind of grasping here to recap that, because we taped the conversation about 6 weeks ago, and as I said, it's 3.5 hours long, so it's just jam-packed. It is absolutely slammed with stuff, and when we wrapped up the conversation, I knew we could have gone another 2, 3, 4 more hours talking. It was just that smooth, and definitely one that I think the BOA Audio listeners are going to absolutely love. That's Dr. Tyler Cokejohn on the next edition of Binall of America Audio Season 7. It is the first episode of the final 4 of Season 7. It'll be episode number 730. Meaning we've only got a handful of programs here left as we wrap up Season 7, so be sure to tune in, my friends. And on that note, we close the book on this edition of the program. Big, big thanks once again to William Michael Mott for coming on the show. Thank you to all the folks out there who put up with my lengthy rant and ramble here at the end of the program. Kind of wanted to just clear the deck a little bit, get this off my mind, and start fresh as we move forward here on Season 7. And I appreciate all the folks who tuned in here and let me vent. Thank you. And, of course, enormous thanks to all you folks out there, the hardcore BOA audio listeners, the ones who are tuning in here to the very end of the program. You are the fuel that drives the BOA mothership. Thank you once again for making BOA audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.